Delilah Gray. 5 a.m. Deathcast called Delilah Gray at 2:52 a.m. to tell her she's going to die today, but she's sure it's not true. Delilah isn't in some denial stage of grief. This has to be a cruel prank from her ex, a Deathcast employee, trying to scare her since she called off their year-long engagement last night. Toying with someone like this is incredibly illegal. This degree of fraud can have him thrown in jail for a minimum of 20 years and blacklisted from working pretty much anywhere ever again. Screwing around on the job at Deathcast is, well, killer. Delilah can't believe Victor would abuse his power like this. She deletes the email with the timestamp receipt of her call with the Herald, Mickey, whom she cursed out before hanging up. She picks up her phone, tempted to call Victor. She shakes her head and places her phone back by the pillow on the side of the bed that was Victor's whenever he stayed over. Delilah refuses to give Victor the satisfaction of thinking she's paranoid, which she isn't. If he's waiting on her to log on to Deathcast.com to see if her name is actually registered on the site as a Decker, or to call him and threaten him with a lawsuit until he admits Mickey is a friend at work he recruited to scare her, he's going to be waiting a very long time. Time she has plenty of. Delilah is moving on with her day because just as she didn't second-guess her decision to call off the engagement, she will not second-guess that bullshit call. She goes to the bathroom and brushes her teeth while admiring her hair in the mirror. Her hair is vibrant. Too vibrant, according to her boss. In the past few weeks, Delilah needed a change. Ignoring the voice in her head urging her to end things with Victor. Dyeing her hair was simpler, fewer tears involved. When asked by the hairdresser what she wanted, Delilah asked for the Aurora Borealis treatment. The combination of pink, purple, green, and blue needs some touch-ups, but that can wait until next week after she catches up on assignments. She returns to bed and opens her laptop. Breaking up with Victor last night before his shift pulled her away from her own work, a season premiere recap she's writing for Infinite Weekly, where she's been working as an editorial assistant since graduating from college this spring. She's not a hipster house fan, but those hipsters are more clickbaity than the Jersey Shore crew, and someone has to write the pieces because the editors are busy covering the respected franchises. Delilah is well aware how lucky she is to be given the grunt work and to have a job at all, considering she's the new hire who missed several deadlines because she was preoccupied planning a wedding with someone she's only known for 14 months. Delilah turns on her TV to rewatch the painfully absurd premiere, a challenge in a crowded Brooklyn coffee shop where the hipsters have to co-write short stories on a typewriter. And before she can switch to her DVR, a Fox 5 anchor shares something truly newsworthy, given her interests. "And we've reached out to his agents for word. The 25-year-old actor may have played the young antagonist of the blockbuster Scorpius Hawthorne films about the demonic boy wizard, but fans all over the world have been sharing nothing but love online for Howie Maldonado. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook for immediate updates on this developing story." Delilah jumps out of bed, her heart pounding. She isn't waiting around for this developing story. Delilah will be the writer who reports the story.
Mateo, 5:20 a.m. I approach the ATM on the corner while Rufus watches my back. My dad thankfully had the common sense to send me to the bank after I turned 18 so I could get a debit card. I withdraw $400, the max limit at this ATM. My heart is pounding as I slide the cash into an envelope for Lydia, praying someone doesn't come out of nowhere and hold us up at gunpoint for the money. We know how that would end. I grab the receipt, memorizing how I have $2,076.27 left in my account as I tear up the slip. I don't need that much. I can get more cash for Lydia and Penny at another ATM or the bank when it opens. It might be too early to go to Lydia's, I say. I fold up the envelope and put it in my pocket. She'll know something is up. Maybe we can hang in her lobby? Nah, dude. We're not sitting around in your bestie's lobby because you don't want to burden her. It's 5 o'clock. Let's eat. Potential last supper. Rufus leads the way. My favorite diner is open 24 hours. Sounds good. I've always been a super fan of mornings. I follow several Facebook pages about mornings in other cities. Good morning, San Francisco. And countries. Good morning, India. And no matter the time of day, in my feed there are pictures of glowing buildings, breakfast, and people beginning their lives. There's newness that comes with the rising sun. And even though there's a chance I won't reach daytime or see sun rays filtering through trees in the park, I should look at today as one long morning. I have to wake up. I have to start my day. The streets are really clear this early. I'm not anti-people. I just don't have the courage to sing in front of anyone. If I were alone right now, I'd probably play some depressing song and sing along. Dad taught me it's okay to give in to your emotions, but you should fight your way out of the bad ones, too. The days after his admittance, I was playing positive and soulful songs, like Billy Joel's Just the Way You Are, so I wouldn't feel hopeless. We reach Cannon Cafe. There's a triangular sign above the door with an illustrated logo of a cannon blasting a cheeseburger toward the cafe's name, with French fries exploding wayward like fireworks. Rufus chains his bike to a parking meter, and I follow him inside the fairly empty cafe, immediately smelling scrambled eggs and French toast. A tired-eyed host greets us, telling us we can sit wherever. Rufus passes me and goes all the way to the back, settling into a two-person booth beside the bathroom. The navy blue leather seats are cracked in various places, and it reminds me of the couch I had as a kid, where I would absent-mindedly peel the fabric off until there was so much exposed cushion foam that Dad threw the couch out for our current one. "This is my spot," Rufus says. "I come here once or twice a week. I get to say stuff like, 'I'll have the usual.'" "Why here? Is this your neighborhood?" I realize I have no idea where my last friend actually lives, or where he's from. "Only for the past 4 months," Rufus says. "I ended up in foster care." Not only do I not know much about Rufus, I haven't done anything for him. He's been all about the mission of shadowing me on my journey, getting me out of my home, going to and getting me out of the hospital, and soon coming with me to Lydia's. This last friendship has been very one-sided so far. Rufus slides the menu my way. "There's a Decker discount on the back. Everything is free, if you can actually believe that." This is a first. In all the Countdowners feeds I've read, the Deckers go to 5-star restaurants expecting to be treated like kings with courtesy meals, but are only ever offered discounts. I like that Rufus returned here. A waitress comes out from the back and greets us. Her blonde hair is pulled back into a tight bun, and the button clipped to her yellow tie reads, "Ray."
"Good morning,"
she greets us in a southern accent. She grabs the pen out from behind her ear, and I glimpse a curly tattoo above her elbow. I'll never grow into someone unafraid of needles. She twirls the pen between her fingers.
"Late night for you two?"
"You could say that," Rufus answers. "Feels more like a really early morning," I counter. If Ray is actually interested in my distinction, she doesn't show it.
"What can I get you two?"
Rufus looks at the menu. "Don't you have a usual?" I ask him.
"Changing it up today. Last chance and all that."
He puts the menu down and looks up at Ray. What do you suggest?
What? Did you get the alert or something?
Her laughter is short-lived. She turns to me, and I lower my head until she crouches beside us.
No way.
She drops her pen and notepad onto the table.
Are you boys okay? Sick? You're not pranking me for a free meal, are you?
Rufus shakes his head. Nah, not kidding. I come here a lot and wanted to roll through one last time.
Are you seriously thinking about food right now?
Rufus leans over and reads her pin. Ray, what should I try? Ray hides behind her hand, shakes her shoulders, and mutters,
I don't know. Don't you just want the everything special? It has fries, sliders, eggs, sirloin, pasta. I mean, it has everything you could want that we have in the kitchen.
No way I'm going to eat all that. What's your favorite meal here? Rufus asks. Please don't say fish.
I like the grilled chicken salad, but that's because I eat like a bird.
I'll have that, Rufus decides. He looks at me. What do you want, Mateo? I don't even bother looking at the menu. I'll have whatever your usual is. Like him, I'm hoping it's not fish. You don't even know what it is. As long as it's not chicken tenders, it'll be something new for me. Rufus nods. He points to a couple items on the menu, and Ray tells us she'll return shortly, then rushes away so quickly she leaves behind her pen and notepad. We overhear Ray telling the chef to make our order priority number one because there are Deckers at the table. Not sure who our competition is, the guy in the back already drinking his coffee while he reads his newspaper. But I do appreciate Ray's heart, and I wonder if Andrea at Deathcast was once like her before the job killed her compassion. Can I ask you something? I say to Rufus. Don't waste your breath on questions like that. Just come out and say whatever you want, he says. He's coming on a little strong, but good call. Why did you tell Ray we're dying? Doesn't that screw with her day? I guess, but dying is screwing with my day, and there isn't anything I can do about it, Rufus says. I'm not telling Lydia I'm dying, I say. That makes no sense. Don't be a monster. You have a chance to say goodbye. You should do it. I don't want to ruin Lydia's day. She's a single mom, and she's already had a rough time since her boyfriend died. Maybe I'm not actually so selfless. Maybe not telling her is really selfish. But I can't bring myself to do it. Because how do you tell your best friend you won't be around tomorrow? How do you convince her to let you leave so you have a chance of living before you die? I push back against my seat, pretty disgusted with myself. If that's your call, I back it. I don't know if she'll resent you or not. You know her best. But look, we gotta stop caring about how others will react to our deaths and stop second-guessing ourselves. What if by not second-guessing our actions, we end ourselves? I ask. Don't you have little freakouts wondering if life was better before Deathcast? This question is suffocating. Was it better? Rufus asks. Maybe. Yes. No. The answer doesn't matter or change anything. Just let it go, Mateo. He's right. I am doing this to myself. I'm holding myself back. I've spent years living safely to secure a longer life, and look where that's gotten me. I'm at the finish line, but I never ran the race. Ray returns with drinks, hands a grilled chicken salad to Rufus, and places sweet potato fries and French toast in front of me.
If there's anything else I can get you boys, please just shout for me. Even if I'm in the back or with another customer, I'm yours.
We thank her, but I can tell she's hesitant about walking away. almost as if she wants to scoot down next to one of us and just talk some more. But she collects herself and walks away. Rufus taps my plate with his fork.
How's my usual looking for you?
I haven't had French toast in years. My dad really got into making BLTs on toasted tortillas every morning instead. I kind of forgot French toast was even a thing, but that cinnamon smell restores many memories of eating breakfast across from Dad at our rickety table while we listened to the news or brainstormed lists he should write. This is pretty perfect. Do you want some? Rufus nods, but doesn't reach over to my plate. His mind is elsewhere as he plays around with his salad, seemingly disappointed and only eating the chicken. He drops his fork and grabs the notepad and pen Ray left behind. He sketches a circle, bold.
I wanted to travel the world taking photos.
Rufus is drawing the world, outlining the countries he'll never get to visit. Like a photojournalist? I ask.
Nah. I wanted to do my own thing.
We should go to the travel arena, I say. It's the best way to travel the world in a single day. Countdowners speak highly of it.
I never read that stuff, Rufus says.
I read it daily, I admit. It's comforting seeing other people breaking out. Rufus glances up from his drawing, shaking his head.
Your last friend is going to make sure you go out with a bang.
Not a bad bang, or a you-know-what bang, but a good bang. That made no sense. I get it. I think.
What did you see yourself doing?
Like, as a job? Rufus asks. An architect. I wanted to build homes and offices and stages and parks, I say. I don't tell him how I never wanted to work in any of those offices, or that I've also dreamt of performing on a stage I've built. I played with Legos a lot as a kid.
Same. My spaceships always came apart. Those smiling, block-headed pilots never stood a chance.
Rufus reaches over and carves himself a piece of French toast and then chews it, savoring the bite with his head down and eyes closed. It's hard watching someone swallow their favorite food one last time. I have to get it together. Things usually get worse before they get better, but today has to be the flip side. Once our plates are clear, Rufus stands and gets Ray's attention.
Could we get the check when you have a sec?
It's on us, Ray says.
Please let us pay. It would mean a lot to me, I say. I hope she doesn't see it as a guilt card.
Seconded, Rufus says.
Rufus may not be able to return here again, but we want to make sure they remain open for as long as possible for others. And money is how they pay the bills. Ray nods vigorously, and she hands us a check. I hand her my debit card, and when she comes back, I tip her triple the inexpensive meal's cost. I have less than $2,000 after this debit charge. I may not be able to restart anyone's life with this money, but every bit helps. Rufus puts his drawing of the world inside his pocket.
Ready to go?
I remain seated. Getting up means leaving, I say.
Yeah,
Rufus says. Leaving means dying, I say.
Nah, leaving means living before you die. Let's bounce.
I stand, thanking Ray and the busboy and the host as we leave. Today is one long morning, but I have to be the one who wakes up and gets out of bed. I look ahead at the empty streets, and I start walking toward Rufus and his bike, walking toward death with every minute we lose, walking against a world that's against us.
Rufus. 5:53 a.m. I can't front. Mateo is cool and neurotic and fine company, but it would have been really dope to have one last sit-down at Cannon's with the Plutos, talking about all the good and bad things that have gone down. But it's too risky. I know what's good with me, and I'm not risking getting them hurt. They could hit me back with a text, though. I unchain my bike and wheel it out onto the street. I toss the helmet to Mateo, who just barely catches it. So, Lydia is right off where again? Why are you giving me this? Mateo asks. So you don't crack your head open if you fall off the bike. I sit on the bike. It would suck if your last friend killed you. This isn't a tandem bike, he says. There are pegs, I say. Tego would ride on the back pegs all the time, trusting me to not crash into any cars and send him flipping off. You want me to stand on the back of your bike while we ride in darkness? Mateo asks. While wearing a helmet, I say. Holy shit. I really thought he was ready to take chances. No. This bike is going to be the death of us. This day is really doing a number on him. No, it won't. Trust me. I've ridden this bike every day for almost 2 years. Hop on, Mateo. He's mad hesitant, that's obvious, but he forces the helmet onto his head. There's extra pressure to be cautious because I'd hate for an "I told you so" in the afterlife. Mateo holds on to my shoulders, pressing down on them as he gets on the pegs. He's stepping his game up. I'm proud of him. It's like pushing a bird out of its nest, maybe even shoving because it should have flown out years ago. A grocery store down the block is opening its roll-up doors for business, as the moon hangs high above this bank up ahead. I press down on a pedal when Mateo hops off. Nope, I'm walking, and I think you should too. He unbuckles the helmet, takes it off his head, and hands it to me. Sorry, I just have this bad feeling, and I have to trust my gut. I should throw on the helmet right away. Let Mateo go to Lydia, and I can do my thing, whatever that is. But instead of parting ways, I hang my helmet off the handlebars and swing my leg over the seat. We should get walking, then. I don't know how much life we have left, but I don't want to miss it.
Mateo, 6:14 a.m. I'm already the worst last friend ever. It's time to be the worst best friend. This is going to suck, I say. Because you're not outing your death? I'm not dead yet. I turn the corner. Lydia's apartment is a couple blocks away. And no, the sky is finally lightening up, the orange haze of my final sunrise ready to take over. Lydia was destroyed when we found out her boyfriend, future husband person was dying. He never got to meet Penny. I take it Penny is their daughter, Rufus says. Yeah, she was born a week after Christian died. How'd that go? The call, Rufus asks. If that's too personal, you don't have to tell me. My family getting their call was a nightmare, and I'm not a big fan of talking about that either. I'm about to trust him with this story as long as he promises not to tell anyone, especially not Lydia, when I realize Rufus will die with this story. Short of him gossiping in some afterlife, I'm safe to tell him anything and everything. Christian was traveling to outer Pennsylvania to sell these weird daggers and swords he inherited from his grandfather to this collector. Weird daggers and swords tend to sell for mad bank, Rufus says. Lydia didn't want him to go because she was having all these hysteria freakouts, but Christian swore the money would be worth it in the long run. They could buy a better crib, diapers and formula for the next couple months, and clothes. He took off, stayed overnight in Pennsylvania, and woke up around 1-something to the alert. My chest tightens, reliving this. All the tears and screams. I stop and rest against the wall. Christian tried reaching Lydia, but she slept through everything. He texted her every minute he could. He'd hitchhiked there with a Decker truck driver, and they both died trying to get back to their families in the city. "Holy shit," Rufus says. There was no consoling Lydia. She obsessively read Christian's final, frantic texts and hated herself for not waking up to any calls. There was a chance for her to see him one last time through the Veil, a video chat app that drains batteries quickly, but also creates a stronger personal hotspot for anyone who's somewhere with weak service, like a Decker on a highway headed home. And she missed those invites, too. I don't know if it's true, but the way Lydia spoke about Penny in the beginning sounded like she resented her for wearing her out so much toward the end of her pregnancy that she slept through her boyfriend's final hours. But I know she was grieving and doesn't feel that way now. Since then, Lydia dropped out of high school to take care of Penny full-time in a small apartment with her grandmother. She's not very tight with her own parents, and Christian's parents live in Florida. Her life is challenging enough without throwing a goodbye into things. I just want to see my best friend one last time.
That's brutal, Rufus says.
It was. Coming from him, it means a lot. Let me call her. I walk a few feet away, giving myself some privacy. I hit call. I can't believe I won't be there for Penny if something fatal strikes Lydia. But I'm also pretty relieved I'll never have to live through Lydia receiving the call.
Mateo?
Lydia groggily answers.
Yeah, were you sleeping?
Sorry, I thought Penny would be awake by now.
Oh, she is. I'm being Mom of the Year by hiding under my pillow while she talks to herself in the crib. Why are you awake at ass o'clock?
I wanted to go see my dad. I'm not lying, after all. Can I come over for a bit? I'm in the area.
Yes, please.
Cool. See you in a bit. I hail Rufus over, and we walk to her apartment. It's in the kind of projects where the superintendent sits on the stoop reading a newspaper when there's clearly more work that can be done, like mopping and sweeping the floor, fixing the blinking lamp in the hallway, and setting up mouse traps. But this doesn't matter to Lydia. The breeze she gets on rainy evenings charms her, and she's taken a liking to her neighbor's cat, Chloe, that wanders the halls and is scared of mice. It's home, you know. I'm going up alone, I tell Rufus. You'll be okay down here?
I'll be fine.
I should call my friends anyway. They haven't responded to anything since I left. I won't be long, I say. And he doesn't tell me to take my time. I run up the stairs, nearly falling face first on the edge of a step before I catch myself on the railing, hovering an inch away from what could have been my death. I can't rush toward Lydia's company on my end day. That urgency can, and almost just did, kill me. I reach the third floor and knock on her door. Penny is screaming from inside.
It's open!
I walk in, and it smells like milk and clean clothes. There's a laundry basket right by the door, clothes spilling out. Empty formula bottles are also on the floor. And inside the playpen is Penny, who doesn't have her Colombian mother's light brown skin tone, but is instead very pale like Christian was, except right now she's red from screaming. Lydia is in the kitchen, warming up a bottle and a cup of hot water.
You are a godsend, Lydia says. I would hug you, but I haven't brushed my teeth since Sunday.
You should go do that.
Hey, nice shirt.
Lydia fastens a top onto the bottle and tosses it to me, right when Penny screams louder.
Just give it to her. She gets pissed if she doesn't hold her own bottle.
Lydia ties her messy hair back with a rubber band and speedwalks toward the bathroom.
Oh my God, I get to pee by myself. I can't wait.
I kneel before Penny and offer her the bottle. She has attitude in her dark brown eyes, but when she grabs the bottle from me and sits back down on a stuffed bear, she smiles and flashes me her four baby teeth before getting to work on her bottle. All the baby books say Penny should be done with formula already, but Penny resists the real stuff. We have that in common. Lydia comes out of the bathroom with a toothbrush hanging from her mouth as she puts batteries into a plastic toy butterfly. She's asking me something, but toothpastey saliva drips down her chin, and she rushes to the kitchen sink and spits. Sorry. Gross. Do you want some breakfast? You're so damn skinny. Gross. I sound like your mother. She shakes her head. Oh, God, you know what I mean. I sound like I'm mothering you. No worries, Lydia. And I ate already, but thanks. I poke Penny's feet while she drinks, and she lowers her bottle to laugh. There's some gibberish I'm sure makes perfect sense to her, and then she returns to her bottle. Guess who got the alert? Lydia asks, waving her phone. I freeze while holding Penny's foot. There's no way Lydia knows I'm dying, and there's no way she'd be this casual about letting me know she is. Who?
Howie Maldonado!
Lydia checks her phone.
His fans are devastated.
I'm sure. I share an end day with my favorite fictional villain. I don't know what to make of that.
How's your dad doing?
Lydia asks. Stable. I keep hoping for one of those TV miracles where he hears my voice and snaps awake, but that obviously didn't happen. Nothing we can do but wait. It's crunching my insides talking about this. I sit beside the playpen and pick up some stuffed animals. A smiling sheep, a yellow owl, and bounce them toward Penny before tickling her. I'll never have any moments like this with my own kids.
I'm sorry to hear that. He'll pull through. Your dad is badass. I keep telling myself he's just taking a nap from all that badassness.
Probably. Penny's done with her bottle. I can burp her.
Godsend, Mateo. Godsend.
I wipe Penny's face clean, pick her up, and pat her back until I get that burp and laugh out of her. I do my signature dinosaur walk, where I stomp around like a T-Rex with Penny in my arms, which always seems to relax her. Lydia walks over and turns on the TV.
Yes, it's 6:30. Time for cartoons, a.k.a. the only time I have to clean up the previous day's messes before it all goes to hell again.
Lydia smiles at Penny, slides toward us, and kisses her on the nose.
What Mommy meant to say is what a treasure her little Penny is.
Under her breath and behind a smile, she adds,
a treasure that leaves nothing buried around.
I laugh and put Penny down. Lydia gives Penny the plastic butterfly and collects clothes from the floor. What can I do to help? I say.
You can never change, for starters. Then you can throw all her toys back in the chest, but leave the sheep alone or she'll freak out. And in return, I will love you forever and ever. I'm going to put her clothes in her drawers. Give me a minute or 10.
Lydia leaves with the laundry basket. Take your time.
Godsend!
I love Lydia in all her forms. Before Penny, she wanted to graduate high school with top honors and go to college to pursue politics and architecture and music history. She wanted to travel to Buenos Aires and Spain, Germany and Colombia. But then she met Christian and got pregnant and found happiness in her new world. Lydia used to be the girl who got her hair straightened after school every Thursday, was always glowing without makeup, and loved photobombing strangers' photos with goofy faces. Now her hair is what she calls somewhat cute, somewhat lion's mane, and she will never approve any photo to go up online because she thinks she looks too burned out. I think my best friend glows even brighter than before because she's been through a change, an evolution that many can't handle. And she's done it solo. When I'm done throwing all the toys back into their chest, I sit down with Penny on the floor, watching as she blows raspberries whenever the cartoon characters ask her questions. This is Penny's beginning. And one day she'll find herself on the terrible end of a death cast call, and it sucks how we're all being raised to die. Yes, we live, or we're given the chance to at least, but sometimes living is hard and complicated because of fear. Penny, I hope you figure out how to become immortal so you can rule this place for as long as you like. Here's my vision of Utopia. A world without violence and tragedies, where everyone lives forever, or until they've led fulfilling and happy lives and decide themselves that they want to check out whatever's next for us. Penny responds with gibberish. Lydia comes out of the other room.
Why are you wishing Penny immortality and world domination while she's learning how to say one in Spanish?
Because I want her to live forever, obviously. I smile. And make minions of everyone else. Lydia's eyebrows rise. She leans over, picks up Penny, and holds her out to me.
Penny, for your thoughts?
We both cringe.
That is never going to be funny, is it? I just keep going for it, hoping that the next time will be it. But no.
Maybe next time, I say.
Honestly, you don't even have to give me your thoughts. If you want Penny, you can have her for free.
She flips Penny around and kisses her eyes and tickles her armpit.
Mommy meant to say that you're priceless, little Penny.
Then she mutters,
the priciest priceless little Penny ever.
She sets Penny back down in front of the TV and continues cleaning. The relationship I have with Lydia isn't the kind you see in movies or maybe have with your own friends. We love each other to death, but we don't go around talking about it. It's understood between us. And words can sometimes be awkward, even when you've known someone for 8 years. But today, I have to say more. I prop up a framed picture of Lydia and Christian that was tipped over. Christian has got to be crazy proud of you, you know? You're Penny's shot at happiness in a world that makes cheap promises and has no guarantees and doesn't always reward those who never did wrong. It's like the world will just as easily screw with a good person as it will a not-so-good one, but you devote your days to someone else selflessly anyway. Not everyone is programmed like you. Lydia stops sweeping.
Mateo, where is this random flattery coming from? What's going on?
I carry a bottle of juice over to the sink. Everything's okay. And everything will be okay. She'll be okay. I should probably head out in a bit. I'm tired. I'm not lying. Lydia's eyes twitch.
Before you go, could you help me with a couple more chores?
We move silently through the living room. She scrubs oatmeal off a pillow, and I dust her air conditioner. She collects cups, and I arrange all of Penny's shoes at the door. She folds laundry, peeking over at me while I break down some diaper boxes.
Could you take out the garbage?
She asks, her voice cracking a little.
Then I need help assembling that little baby bookcase you and your dad got Penny.
Okay. I think she's catching on. I place the envelope of cash on the kitchen counter when she leaves the room. Even as I grab the trash bag out of the bin, I know I won't be able to return. I step out into the hallway and throw the bag down the chute. If I go back in, I'll never leave. And if I don't leave, I'll die in that apartment, possibly in front of Penny, and that's not how I want to be remembered. Rufus's approach is really smart and thoughtful. I pull out my phone and block Lydia's number so she can't call or text me to come back. I feel nauseous and a little dizzy, slowly making my way back downstairs, hoping Lydia understands, and hating myself so much I race down the stairs faster and faster.
Rufus, 6:48 a.m. Who put down $10 I'd find myself on Instagram on my end day? Because you're now $10 richer. The Plutos still haven't responded to a single text or phone call. I'm not freaking out too hard because they're not Deckers, but damn. Could someone at least let me know if the cops are still on my ass or not? My money's on everyone being passed out. I'd nap too if you put a bed in front of me. A chair with armrests would work as well. Definitely not this lobby bench that could seat two people max. I'm not about to rest fetus position style. That's not me. I'm scrolling through Instagram, expecting to find a new post from Malcolm's account, at Manthony012. But there's been nothing since 9 hours ago, when he uploaded that unfiltered photo of a Coca-Cola bottle with his name on it. He's Team Pepsi in a world war of Pepsi versus Coke. But he was so happy seeing his name in that bodega fridge that he couldn't resist. The caffeine only got him more hype before the fight. I shouldn't call that thing with Peck a fight. Peck couldn't even get a swing on me with the way I pinned him. I'm texting Amy an apology, even though I only half mean it because her little shit boyfriend unleashed the cops on me at my own damn funeral. When Mateo comes running down the stairs at a dangerous speed, he's bulleting to the front door, and I catch up with him. His eyes are red, and he's breathing hard, like he's fighting back a serious cry. You good? He's not. That was stupid to ask. No. Mateo pushes the lobby door open. Let's go before Lydia chases me down. I'm eager to get a move on too, believe me, but his silent mode isn't gonna fly with me. I wheel my bike alongside him. Come on. Get whatever it is off your chest. Don't carry this around all day. I don't have all day. Mateo shouts. Like someone finally pissed off he's dying at 18. Turns out there's some fire in him. He stops at the curb and sits down, straight reckless, probably waiting for a car to knock him out of his misery. Down goes my bike's kickstand, up goes Mateo, as I slide my arms under his and pick him up. We move away from the curb and lean against the wall, and he's shaking, like he really doesn't want to be out here. And when he slides down to the ground, I go with him. Mateo takes off his glasses and rests his forehead on his knees. Look, I'm not going to hit you with some impassioned speech. I don't have one in me, and that's not what I'm about. I gotta do better than that. But I know that frustration you're feeling, dude. You have options, thankfully. If you want to go back to your dad or best friend, I'm not stopping you. If you want to ditch me, I'm not chasing you. It's your last day. Live it however the hell you want. If you want help living it, I got you. Mateo lifts his head and squints at me. Sounded pretty impassioned to me. Yeah, my bad. I like him better with his glasses, but no glasses is a good look on him too. What do you want to do? If he ditches, I'll respect that, and I'll figure out my next move. I gotta see what's what with the Plutos, but I can't sneak back there. I don't know if there are eyes on the place. I want to keep moving forward, Mateo says. Good call. He puts his glasses back on, and I don't know. If you want to put together some analogy on how he's seen the world with new eyes or something, be my guest. I'm just relieved I'm not taking this day on alone. I'm sorry for yelling, Mateo says. I still think not saying goodbye is the right move, but it's something I'll regret all day. I didn't get to say my piece to my friends either, I say. What happened at your funeral? All my talk about honesty and getting stuff off your chest and I'm not being straight with him. It got interrupted. I haven't been able to reach my friends again since then. I'm hoping they'll hit me up before I crack my knuckles as cars go by. I want them to know I'm okay. No mystery if I'm dead yet or not. But I can't keep texting them until whatever happens finally goes down. Set up a Countdowner's profile, Mateo suggests. I've followed enough stories online, and I can help you navigate it. I bet he can. Going by that logic, I've watched enough porn to make me a sex god. Nah, that stuff isn't me. I never even got on board with Tumblr or Twitter, just Instagram. The photography stuff is still pretty new, just a few months. Instagram is dope. Can I see your account? Sure. I hand him my phone. My profile is public because I don't care if some stranger stumbles onto it. But it's crazy different watching a stranger scroll through my photos. I feel exposed, like I'm stepping out of the shower and someone is watching me wrap a towel around my boys. My earlier photos are pretty amateur hour because of bad lighting, but there's no edit button, and that's probably for the best. Why are they all in black and white? Mateo asks. I got the account a few days after I moved into the foster home. My boy Malcolm took this one photo of me. Look. I scoot closer to him and scroll down to my first wave of photos, self-conscious about my dirty fingernail for half a second, before no longer giving a shit. I click the photo of me sitting on my bed at Pluto with my face in my hands. Malcolm is the credited photographer. It was my third or fourth night there. We were playing board games, and I was freaking out in my head because I was feeling guilty for having a decent time. Nah, kill that. I was having mad fun. That's what made it worse. I walked away without a word, and Malcolm hunted me down because I was taking too long and he captured my breakdown. Why? Mateo asks. He said he liked tracking a person's growth, and not just physically. He's hard on himself, but he's smart as hell. But for real, I kicked Malcolm in his giant knee when he first showed me that photo weeks later. Creep. I keep my photos in black and white because my life lost color after they died. And you're living your life, but not forgetting theirs? Mateo asks. Exactly. I thought people got on Instagram just to be on Instagram. I shrug. Old school. Your photos look old school, Mateo says. He shifts, looking at me with wide eyes. He smiles at me for the first time, and yo, this is not the face you see on a Decker. You don't need the Countdowners app. You can post everything here. You can create a hashtag or whatever, too. But I think you should post your life in color. Let that be how the Plutos remember you. The smile goes away because that's the nature of today. Forget it. That's stupid. It's not stupid, I say. I actually really like this. The Plutos can revisit the times I lived with them in black and white, like a cooler history book. And my end day will have its own unfiltered contrast. Can you take a pic of me sitting here? In case it's my last post, I want everyone to see me alive. Mateo smiles again, like he's the one posing for the photo. He gets up and points the camera my way. I don't pose. I just sit here with my back against the wall, in the spot where I convinced my last friend to keep adventuring, and where he gave me the idea to add some life to my profile. I don't even smile. I've never been a smiler, and starting now feels off. I don't want them to see a stranger. Got it, Mateo says. He hands me the phone. I can take another if you hate it. I don't care about photo approval. I'm not that into myself. The photo was surprisingly dope, though. Mateo caught me looking sad and proud all at once. Like my parents looked the day Olivia graduated high school. And the front wheel of my bike makes a cameo, too. Thanks, dude. I upload the picture unfiltered. I consider captioning it with hashtag end day, but I don't need fake sympathetic, oh no, rest in peace comments or trolls telling me to rest in pieces. The people who matter the most to me know. And I hope they remember me as I was, and not as the guy who punched in someone's face earlier for no real good reason.
Patrick Peck Gavin, 7:08 a.m. Deathcast did not call Patrick Peck Gavin because he's not dying today, though he was expecting the alert before his attacker received the call himself. He's home now, pressing a frozen hamburger patty against his bruises. It smells, but the migraine is fading away. Peck shouldn't have left Amy in the street, but she didn't want to see him, and he's not exactly happy with her either. He used his old phone and called Amy up, but the arguing only lasted so long before she began passing out from exhaustion, and it was so hard not to hang up on her when she said she wanted to make an effort to see Rufus again, to be with him on his end day. Peck used to operate by a code with people like Rufus. A code that goes into play when someone tries to walk all over you. Peck has a lot to sleep on, but things aren't looking good for Rufus if he's still around when Peck wakes up.
Rufus, 7:12 a.m. My phone vibrates, and I'm counting on it being the Plutos, but that hope gets squashed once a chime follows. Mateo checks his phone and gets the same notification. Another message we both got today. Make a moment location nearby. 1.2 miles. I suck my teeth. What the hell is this? You never heard of it? Mateo asks. They launched last fall. Nope. I keep it moving down the block, half listening, half wondering why the Plutos haven't hit me back yet. It's sort of like the Make-A-Wish Foundation, Mateo says, but any Decker can go. It's not just for kids. They have these low-grade virtual reality stations designed to give you the same thrills as crazy experiences like skydiving and race car driving and other extreme risks Deckers can't safely experience on their end day. So it's a straight-up ripoff, watered-down version of the Make-A-Wish Foundation? I don't think it's all that bad, Mateo says. I check my phone again to see if I've missed any messages. As I step off the curb, Mateo's arm bangs into my chest. I look right, he looks right. I look left, he looks left. There are no cars. The street is dead quiet. I know how to cross the street, I say. I've sort of been walking my entire life. You were on your phone, Mateo says. I knew no cars were coming, I say. Crossing the street is pretty instinctive at this point. If there are no cars, you go. If there are cars coming toward you, you don't go. Or you go really quickly. I'm sorry, Mateo says. I want this day to last. He's on edge, I know, but he needs to step off at some point. I get it, but walking, I got this. I look both ways again before crossing the empty street. If anyone should be nervous, it's the guy who watched his family drown in a sinking car. I didn't exactly beat my grief to the point where I would have ever seen myself comfortably getting in a car over the next few years. But then there's Malcolm, who digs fireplaces even though he lost his parents to a house fire. I don't have that in me. But I'm also not looking right to left, left to right, like Mateo is, until we make it to the opposite curb. Like there's a 99% chance a car will pop out of nowhere and run us down in 0.5 seconds. Mateo's phone rings. Make a moment, people making house calls? I ask. Mateo shakes his head. Lydia is calling from her grandmother's phone. Should I? He puts his phone back in his pocket and doesn't answer. Well played on her end, I say. At least she's reaching out. Haven't heard shit from my friends. Keep trying. Why not? I park my bike against the wall and FaceTime Malcolm and Tego. Both are no-goes. I FaceTime Amy, and right when I'm about to hang up and send all the Plutos a picture of me flipping them off, Amy answers. Breathing quickly, her eyes strained, her hair sticking to her forehead. She's home. I was knocked out, Amy shakes her head. What time is... You're alive? You... She loses my eyes for a second. She's staring at one half of Mateo's face. She leans over like the phone's camera is a window she can stick her head out of for a closer look. It's like when I was 13 and flipping through magazines. I'd scout for pictures of girls in skirts and dudes in shorts and would tilt the page to see what was underneath. Who's that? This is Mateo, I say. He's my last friend. Mateo waves. And this is my friend Amy. I don't add that she's the girl who body slammed my heart because I'm not trying to make everyone uncomfortable here. I've been calling you. I'm sorry. Everything got crazy after you left, Amy says, rubbing her eyes with her fist. I got home a couple hours ago and my phone was dead, and I set it to charge but fell asleep before it came back on. What the hell happened? Malcolm and Tego got arrested, Amy says. They wouldn't stop mouthing off, and Peck threw them under the bus since they were with you. I storm away from Mateo, telling him to stay put. He looks pretty frightened. So much for taking any suspicion of me being a shitty person to the grave. Are they okay? Which station? I don't know, Roof, but you shouldn't go looking around for them unless you want to spend your last day in a holding cell where who knows what will happen to you. This is bullshit! They didn't do anything! I raise my fist to punch in this car window, but that's not me. I swear it's not. I don't go around hitting things and hitting people. I slipped up with Peck. That's that. And what's good with Peck? He followed me home, but I didn't want to talk to him. You ended things with him, right? She doesn't answer. If we were chatting on the phone instead of over video, I wouldn't have to be disappointed by the face she's giving me. I could pretend she's nodding her head, getting ready to break up with him if she hadn't already. But that's not what I'm seeing.
It's complicated, Amy says.
You know, Ames, it didn't seem complicated or confusing when you broke up with me. That legit sucks, but there isn't a bigger kick to the nuts than you turning your back on the Plutos for the punk-ass kid who got them locked up. We're supposed to be tight, and I'm going to be out the picture soon enough, and you're actually going to tell me to my face that you're keeping that motherfucker in your life? Screw body slamming my heart. This girl ripped her own out mad long ago. They were innocent.
Rufus, they weren't totally innocent. You know that, right?
Yeah, bye. Gotta get back to my real friend. Amy begs me not to hang up, and I hang the hell up anyway. I can't believe my boys are in jail for my stupidity, and I can't believe she didn't tell me sooner. I turn around to tell Mateo everything, but he's gone.
Amy Dubois, 7:18 a.m. Amy gives up calling Rufus. There are three possible explanations for why Rufus isn't picking up, ranked from greatest hope to biggest fear. One, he's ignoring her but will call her back. Two, he's blocked her number and has no interest in reaching out. Three, he's dead. Amy goes on Rufus's Instagram, leaving comments on his pictures, asking him to call her back. She charges her phone, raises the volume, and changes into an old T-shirt of Rufus's and her shorts. Amy has really gotten into exercise ever since becoming a Pluto. When she